supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Suicide is a difficult topic to talk about, to think about, to tackle on the air, and some of it's due to how painful it is to imagine someone wanting to take their own life or actually doing it. Some of it has to do with shame or cultural, even religious taboos. I get that, and still fully believe that it's an important topic to be discussed. That's the only way we can eliminate some of the shame attached to it. We open a conversation today about suicide in light of two creative projects that have surfaced here in Philadelphia. One's a mural by Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program, and the other is a story writing workshop that will culminate with actors reading and performing personal essays by suicide survivors. These projects are valuable in so many ways, especially in terms of raising awareness and creating a community around this topic. My guests today have their hands in both projects. Jonathan Singer is an assistant professor of social work at Temple University. He works a lot with young people at risk for suicide, and he joins us here in the studio. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
Terry Erbacher is a school psychologist for the Delaware County Intermediate Unit. She's a clinical assistant professor at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, and she's done great work in the field of suicide prevention. And she joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
Programming note. Today's topic might not be suitable for some children, so be judicious about that. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd really like to hear from you because we want to put a human face on this difficult topic. Terry, like I said, it is a difficult topic, so if people haven't been touched directly by this issue, why would they want to listen to the show, or should they?
Absolutely, Dan. I was going to say, you know, one of the great things is the fact that you're willing to talk about this. I think it's wonderful to have the show. Suicide impacts a lot more people than we realize. You know, you can walk down the street and you have no idea what person might be impacted, either personally or they know somebody. You know, so many people face depression that aren't willing to talk about it. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has what they call an out of the darkness walk, because so many people are in that darkness in silence and nobody knows who might be facing that depression. So it's important for all of us to pay attention to this so we can look out for each other.
I wonder how many people have thought about suicide. It's got to be a vast majority. I'm not talking about people with clinical depression, but people under stress. It's got to be the majority of people. Jonathan, the statistics around suicide are pretty troubling. I mean, the numbers are sky high. But even more troubling for me is, you know, the mantra is that 90x percent of suicides are committed by people who have a untreated or undertreated mental illness. So suicide rates have been stable for a long, long time, but now they're climbing, and especially with young kids and older people. Why?
I think the question of why is it's like the holy grail of research, and we don't know why. There are a couple of theories as to why people die by suicide. One of the things that we know about suicide rates especially for youth, is that rates for youth suicidal behavior have stayed the same or decreased among white males over the last 15, 20 years, but they have risen among African-American males and Latinas. And those rates, and also Native American youth, those rates have shifted the trajectory of what we understand to be the rise, the recent rise, again, in youth suicide rates. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing different groups that previously weren't killing themselves who are now killing themselves.
I read, Jonathan, speaking of those two groups, that the rate of suicide attempts here in Philadelphia among public high school students is almost twice the national average.
Yeah, from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, that's my understanding, is that even though death by suicide is no higher and perhaps is a little bit smaller than comparable cities around the country, Chicago, L.A., New York, suicide attempt rates and ideation are way higher. And it's not clear why. Nobody has done a study to answer that question about why that would be the case.
It's really troubling. And African-American youth, especially, I mean, it's just nobody has any idea. Terry, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, just one thing I was going to add to that is the idea of attempters and that number increasing. I think one of the good things that's coming out of us talking about it a little bit more now is that we're paying more attention to attempters. So I think that's also that we have more data now than we used to, because we're just paying attention more. So it's really hard to know how many people are attempting because how is it documented? And crisis centers now are paying more attention to their documentation of that, so we get better numbers. So that could be a part of that increase also.
There's a question I was going to bring up later, but it begs to be asked now. And we haven't collected accurate data. Children are not being treated or being undertreated, and it's all about stigma. And why? That's unabated stigma. I mean, you know, I know you guys, I have, most people in community mental health have done everything we can to diminish shame, and still it hasn't been diminished. And yet shame gets diminished across the board with most other illnesses.
Right, like cancer.
Yeah,
it's the classic example. You know, you'd see these movies from 30, 40 years ago, and people would say, "Oh, did you hear about Lois? She has cancer."
Right.
They'd whisper. But these days, people go on walks, they wear pink ribbons. The same has not been done for suicide, and that is a huge barrier for people to getting.
Why?
You know, that's such a great question. So
listen, you're the expert. You keep telling me I ask great questions.
All right. So maybe it's not such a great question. No, it is. It's a great question. So here's the thing. So when you've got, let's talk about a kid who wants to kill himself or is thinking about suicide. The kid probably thinks nobody understands me. There is no hope. And so there's this sense of personal failure. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you're the parent and you know about this, then you're going to have shame about, I can't provide for my child. Or maybe I don't want to provide for my child, depending on who the parent is. And then around that, you have all of the religious beliefs that may support
the shame.
You have community supports, people in schools, people in your local restaurant, anybody that you tell, you're like, yeah, it's been really rough. You know, my kid's been thinking about killing himself. Like, first of all, people don't say that, but if they do,
right,
the response is typically like, well, that's just crazy talk. He's a good kid. Why would he do that?
Right. He's got a good life.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to shift gears here a little bit and come back to you, Terry. I want to talk about your writing workshop, because that's really interesting to me. It was done at Horizon House.
Those are two different workshops. There was a workshop, a collage workshop, done with Theodore Harris at Horizon House. And the storytelling workshop was done through Molly Layton, who is a psychologist as well as a storyteller. So she worked with a group of individuals, both survivors. And when we say survivor, that refers to someone who's lost a loved one to suicide. So her storytelling workshop had both survivors as well as attempters, those who have attempted suicide and survived to tell their story, which is wonderful.
So your impetus for getting involved in this project was based on an essay that you wrote many years ago about the death of your father from suicide.
Correct.
Tell us what you said, Terry.
In my story? Mm-hmm. Well, my story was written right after my father's death, whereas most of the stories they'll be doing at First Person Arts, they wrote recently. So it's a pretty raw story right after he had passed. Just telling the story of how I, you know, the shock, really, is how it starts. You know, the shock of hearing on the phone that your father had died and he had taken his life, something that's sort of unimaginable at that time, you know, and sort of all the family dynamics that go from there.
How old were you?
It was 10 years ago, so 27. Yeah, it was 10 years ago this year, actually.
So. What were the family dynamics?
Well, it's interesting. My mother and I deal with everything very differently. I'm more of the emotional, want to hold on to things. So even when it came to, you know, his belongings and how she dealt with that versus how I dealt with that, I want to hold on to everything. She's ready to kind of get rid of and move on. So all those kinds of things. Even she was living in Massachusetts at the time. So getting myself up to Massachusetts, some family who lives in New Jersey took me up there. And, you know, I think I was in shock for several days before it even began to set in.
And when it set in, were you angry at your father?
Sure. I went through a slew of emotions, anger being one of them. And the anger really stemming from, you know, as a daddy's little girl, so to speak, which I certainly was, how could you leave me? And sort of taking it on as that me thing. Which, you know, once you gain a better understanding of depression, he was not thinking about me. You know, he wanted his emotional pain to end. And that's what a lot of people feel. So, you know, coming to that realization. But as a daughter first, and a psychologist later, you know, my very first thing was, how could you leave me? You know, whereas my mother didn't feel any of that anger. She purely just felt sad for him.
What's your relationship now with your father inside yourself?
It's very different. You know, since his death, my career has taken a shift.
Yeah.
Dramatically, as you can imagine. And now I do all this suicide prevention work, which I had not done prior. So really, my whole career has taken a shift. And I really feel like this career shift was in honor of him. So it's sort of nice that I get to do my work in his memory. And this mural that Mural Arts Program is doing means a ton because of that.
Yeah, I want to get to that. Jonathan, it was that mural that inspired this show. The mural's called Finding the Light Within. It'll be installed at 30th Street in Philadelphia this spring. We're going to hear from James Burns in a minute. He was the artist. But it got started when Burns heard you being interviewed by WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott. What were you and Mike and talking about?
I believe we were talking about one of the youth suicides that had occurred. I think it was the Innerborough High students that had killed themselves on the train tracks, and we were talking about that. We were talking about the issues around youth suicide and some of the stigma and things like that.
Yeah, and especially with that suicide and so many suicides, people think that it's about a boyfriend breaking up or a failed grade, and it's never about that, almost never about that. By the way, you can hear the full interview of that interview with Mike and Scott and Jonathan Singer,
that's okay,
at newsworks.org. So let's come back to James Burns when he approached you. What were his ideas, and how did that develop?
Yeah, it was a really interesting conversation for me because he is an artist first, and he did not know anything about suicide to speak of. And so he just asked me all of the basic questions that folks that don't know anything about suicide ask, like, why do people do it? How many people do it? Where should we do a mural? Like, where is the place in Philadelphia where people deal with suicide? And people deal with suicide everywhere in Philadelphia. And that was one of the big challenges with a mural arts project, where you physically have a mural. And so we had to have all of those conversations. How do you create a physical mural? And that's one of the reasons why we decided to go for this storytelling website, so we could harness the power of the internet and have people tell stories regardless of where they were, regardless of what time it was, because it could be 3 a.m. mm-hmm. and you're thinking about your father who killed himself or your son who just tried to kill himself. And nobody's around, but the internet's around, and everybody on the internet's around. And so that's one of the ways that came out.
Well, let's listen to a discussion I had earlier with James Burns. Actually, I spoke with him last week about his mural on this topic of suicide. Let's play back some of our interview. James, going into this project, how much did you know about suicide?
Not as much as I know now. I knew that my grandfather had committed suicide, but I don't know that I knew a whole lot about crisis or the duration of it, or that it was the third leading cause of death in teenagers.
I need to follow up on the issue of your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Were you alive when he committed suicide?
No, my mother, I think, was under 10 years old, and her father was had recently lost his wife to breast cancer and was raising 3 children on his own. And I think he had, a real hard time with it.
Tell us about the project.
You know, my first thought was, wow, what does that look like? What does a mural that deals with suicide look like? We had a storytelling workshop where we had survivors and we had individuals who had dealt with crisis, and we advertised for it. As a group, it was an incredible bonding experience. The folks that showed up for that session, or those sessions, were just amazing.
And tell us about that.
I heard stories about mothers who've lost their sons, one young woman who lost her boyfriend. You know, it's very personal, really incredibly personal stories and intimate stories. I can only imagine they're really... It was difficult to tell those stories, but I think at the same time it was kind of a catharsis to be able to share. And I think that we created this safe space.
Tell us what they shared.
Moments leading up to finding a loved one, the news of hearing about what had happened, and the slow realization of that it wasn't by the hand of another person, but it was actually, you know, a suicide, and how that slowly came to light. People shared a lot.
So here's the story I'm hearing so far,
mm-hmm.
that it starts with an idea, a mural around suicide.
Right.
The next step is people and hearing stories. How does that translate to a mural?
Well, I guess the the way that I work it's based in research, and I think this being such a highly emotional project, we had to really talk with people and work towards an image that made sense for everyone, and that's how I feel comfortable working, I guess. Some of the folks who participated in the storytelling workshops sent me pictures of the people that they had lost while they were together to possibly use some of those images for the mural. You know, it's strange to have that story in my mind and then see that person and having that realization that person is gone from someone's life, that the reality of it is just overwhelming. And
what is the image?
It's an image of, it depicts a crisis to some degree. You have an image of a sort of anonymous figure in a boat, and the water around the boat, it's very choppy and tumultuous, and there's a figure on the shore throwing a lifeline, a life ring to the person in the boat. But even beyond that, there's a network of individuals that are connected by the survivor's quilt that sort of wrap around as almost a double ring. So you have the smaller, more immediate life ring, and then you have the community of individuals that surround that moment of crisis.
Tell us what you learned on this project about yourself, about suicide, and even about survival for family members, loved ones.
I mean, first of all, I've learned how difficult and how taboo it is. The idea that this is the Suicide Project, before we had a name for it, that's what it was called, and people would cringe. And I think that is part of the problem about dealing with suicide, is just being able to talk about it.
That was artist James Burns, a picture of his grandfather, who also took his own life, is included on the mural, Finding the Light Within. We've posted a picture of the mural on our website, whyy.org. Terry, the project is about storytelling. It's about painting words, converting stories to images. But to what end? I mean, what's the dream here for this project?
I think for me, Dan, and a lot of us, the dream is getting the word out there and connection. You know, James talked a little bit about that inside ring and the person on that life raft who he didn't mention is looking down. So someone's throwing a life ring to this person in a boat who can't see it. It's like the help is right there, but you cannot see it. And then on the outside, you have all these people just connecting in various ways, you know, around this survivor's quilt. And that's the whole thing, is connection. You're not alone. He also mentioned through the storytelling workshop what a bonding experience that was. And I really believe a huge part of that was because they connected. They shared their stories with each other and felt a strong connection.
So is it for survivors? Is it for people who have attempted, or is it for the larger community?
I think it's for all of them. Yeah, everybody, you know, so that we look at this. I mean, everybody will interpret it differently,
sure,
as with most artwork. But I think it's for everybody, you know, everybody who's been impacted or just has not been impacted yet, you know, but wants a greater understanding or can see how other people maybe have felt by this.
We're talking about suicide today and expressing all of the emotions around it, a lot through the arts. When we come back, we're going to hear about an attempter's story. Well, that's what we're talking about with my guests, Jonathan Sager and Terry Erbacher. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. If suicide has touched your life, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your story. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Christiana Care Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices. Many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar, when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children. Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about suicide today and the pain and the healing expressed through the arts. Jonathan Sager is an assistant professor of social work at Temple, who does work with young people at risk. Terry Erbacher is a school psychologist for the Delaware County intermediate unit and a clinical assistant professor at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. We're going to hear from our guests in just a couple of minutes, but first we're going to hear from a woman who has lived attempting suicide.
Where do I want to begin telling my story? I believe it was on a Saturday because my husband was home. It was a very cold and dreary day, December 2004. I had been severely depressed for a number of days. For weeks I had been telling people that something was wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. I had talked to my doctor, my husband, even my supervisor at work. No one seemed to understand what I was saying. I told them that I felt like a rubber band that was ready to snap. I felt as though I was being ignored. I was so depressed. It felt like I was in darkness and I could not see light. It felt like I was outside. The moon and the stars were hidden and I could not see my hands in front of my face.
I hear you describing isolation that you felt, and it was intense.
Yes. There was nobody around me. That's what it felt like. And because nobody was listening to me and I was asking for help, and I felt I was being ignored, so I felt like I was in this box, nobody around, I couldn't get out, and nobody could get in.
And the next paragraph describes a terrible fight you had with your husband.
Right.
You were severely depressed at the time, and you told him you wanted to kill yourself. What were you struggling with?
At that time, I had just reached a point where I was really tired, and I was tired of trying to get help. I was tired of trying to explain to people what was going on with me, and I just felt like there was no use in living.
After the fight with your husband, I mean, this was 7 years ago, you left your home on a bitter cold night, and you began to run.
I was trying to get away from home as far as I could, because not only did I feel like committing suicide, but I was afraid I was going to hurt my husband. And that frightened me more than anything. So I started running because I needed to get away from home. I felt like that wasn't a safe place to be.
You sought help at a local hospital. Eventually, you were treated for bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And you write that you still have low points that others don't really understand.
Even though I'm on medication, it's still, there are times when I get depressed. And I get upset when I tell people this call and say, well, how are you feeling? And I go, like, I'm not feeling too good today. I'm depressed. Well, why are you depressed? And I'm upset because they know I'm bipolar and I don't always know why I'm depressed. And so I kind of get irritated. And then I don't want to talk to anybody because they still don't understand. And I get upset about being questioned.
Can you read the last part of the essay that you wrote?
Sure. I have tried to explain to family and friends about bipolar disorder. My husband and I are still together, you know, for better or for worse. To me, he seems to be ambivalent to my being bipolar. I talk to my pastor, and I continue to see my therapist and take my medicine. I am afraid to stop taking my medicine because I don't want to be crazy again. After so many years of being frustrated by family and friends, I have given up on trying to educate them about my mental condition. Now I'm focusing on taking care of myself, accepting that I am bipolar, and no one needs to understand me but myself. Writing about my insanity has been a tremendous help and has helped me to come to terms with myself. I feel free.
How hard was it to write about this? And was this a kind of a coming out about your struggle when you put it in writing into words?
It was hard in the beginning because with this group of people that I was with, I didn't know anyone and I didn't want to share anything with anybody because I didn't want to feel exposed. But as the moderator encouraged us to write, and we began to read in the sessions what we had written. And I heard the other stories. I realized that I wasn't alone. And so I felt free to explore what I was feeling and to share with others. And it really freed me up. It did more for me than any session I ever had with a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm.
Have you written anything else?
No, but it's in me. I just shared with the moderator from this class that I really need to write something else. I feel that need. I could not believe how writing this one piece just gave me peace and calm and helped me to look inside of myself, to see myself better, and even to understand myself. So, yes, I'm getting ready to write my next piece.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was our producer, Jennifer Lynn, speaking with Clara Williams. She's an essayist who's participating in a first-person arts storytelling project. Her essay was called My Insanity. For more information, we've got that on our website at whyy.org/voices. And there's a free event coming up here on Sunday, November 13th at 1 p.m. at Christ Church Neighborhood House here in Philadelphia. Actors and musicians are going to perform stories written by people whose lives have been touched by suicide. And their stories serve as the inspiration for the mural we've been telling you about. Listen, before we get back to the interview, I want to give out some numbers here. 1-800-SUICIDE, and that's for anybody who's contemplating it or feels like they're on the edge. Please call that number, 1-800-SUICIDE, or 800-273-TALK, either one of those numbers. But please call if you're thinking about it or are not trusting yourself. Jonathan, the thing that strikes me about Clara's statement, My Insanity, is the theme is how alone she feels, how misunderstood she feels. What makes that unbearable? I mean, that's a risk factor, is when people feel alone and isolated. What makes that emotion so unbearable that it feels life-threatening?
Well, I think it's like a feedback loop. You know, it starts to build. There's a feeling or there's a thought, and it starts to come back on itself, and you think, I'm alone, and you feel sad, and then you feel sad, and you've clearly and you start thinking nobody's going to want to hear about this, and then if you think nobody's going to hear about this, then you're just beside yourself because there's no hope. There's nobody out there, and it does. It starts to. It's like you're in your own echo chamber. And one of the other things that she said that I thought was so important is that even when she said to other people, "I need help," they weren't hearing her. They were not hearing her saying, "My life is at risk." I'm not sure what they were hearing, but they weren't hearing what she wanted them to hear. And when you work with somebody, you have to be aware that they might be talking about killing themselves. And so as professionals, it is important to say, have you had thoughts of hurting yourself? Do you have thoughts about wanting to die? Have you had thoughts about wanting to kill yourself? Because that can open a conversation that otherwise is closed.
Terry, I've got to tell you, maybe I'm naive, but I was pretty surprised at that statement. I mean, we can talk forever about seeing a look in someone's eyes or change in behavior or isolation or all that stuff. But here's a woman who said, I need help. Please tell me that's unusual, what happened to her, that when someone says, I need help, they would get help.
I wish I could tell you, Dan, that that was unusual, but I think it happens more often than we'd like to say. It's, as you know, it's so hard to say I need help and ask for it.
Yeah.
And it goes along with the stigma, too. People don't always know what to do. A lot of people feel stigma if they lose a loved one to suicide, because when you say it, hey, I lost my father to suicide, people turn and walk away because they don't know how to respond. And I think in this case, too, a lot of times people don't know how to respond, so they choose the nothing response, which obviously we can lose lives because of that. It's huge. Jonathan and I were talking about a professional, you know, psychologist who didn't see that, you know, and didn't do something. And so I think it happens way more often than we'd like to admit. And that's why the education is so very important. And the show is important to really get it out there. We need to do something. We need to look out for each other.
Let's go to the phones. Okay. We've got Debbie on the line. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. You all said earlier that how suicide is still considered taboo, and you wondered why. And my thing is, I have twice attempted suicide. And what I hear from people is that, oh, if you committed suicide or you attempted suicide, you're weak. And I don't think that's the point at all. It takes somebody strong to do it, not be weak.
I'm not so sure I would agree with either characterization. I don't think it's about strength and weakness. I think it's about suffering. And it's, you know, it's not about strength or weakness. I'm curious, Debbie, before we have our guests weigh in on this, what's the impact of you when people call you weak? What's that like for you?
For me?
Yeah.
I take great resentment to it when I hear people say, oh, well, so-and-so committed suicide, they were weak. I take great resentment to that.
Hmm. Do you feel safe, or do you still feel you're at risk for hurting yourself?
There are times that I usually manage to work through it. The last time, the best analogy I can give it is I felt like I was boxed into a corner with no place to turn. And I felt that my children were better off without me. I was in a very repressed marriage, very controlling marriage, and I just felt like I was boxed into a corner with no place to go, and my kids were better off with my husband than they were with me.
And now?
I'm in a second marriage. And, you know, things right now are tight, but, you know, my kids are grown. I've got grandchildren. But it's, you know, it's good right now.
Good. I'm curious about, and I do appreciate your call, Debbie, and this whole phenomenon of strength and weakness is really interesting to me. Obviously, I've got a lot of feelings about it, but I'd like to hear from my guests, and I'm going to thank you for calling in, and best of luck for you, Debbie. I hope you enjoy those grandchildren. Jonathan?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of the things that I took out of what Debbie was saying is that there was a place of desperation and hopelessness that she was in, and that perhaps the strength that she was referring to was really a sense of, this is something that I can control, and I can control whether or not I live and whether or not I die. I think that characterizing it as being in a place of strength is really contrary to what we think about as strength, because I think we think strength is wanting to live and being strong enough to figure out how to live successfully. But I do think that that's something that when people survive a suicidal crisis, I think that maybe one way they can cope is by saying, you know, I was strong enough to say, I'm going to do something about it. I chose not to kill myself. And now I'm out on the other side.
Yeah, Terry, I've learned after being a quadriplegic for 30 years that real strength is about the ability to say, please help me. I'm feeling weak now. Please help me.
Absolutely. And that's not easy to do. You know, one of the things she mentioned, Debbie mentioned too, is people, you know, how hurtful it is to her when people think she's weak. And that made me think back to what Clara said about people asking, well, why are you depressed? You have a good life, you know. And I think that's where we need to understand depression better, you know, that it's chemical in the brain. And it's not, you know, because like you said, a girlfriend broke up with me. It's not always that simple. There's a possibility it could be, but typically it goes far deeper. There's multiple triggers, multiple things that have happened, most of which we don't understand. You know, we don't know Debbie's full story, and I'm sure there's a lot to that too. And that's the thing we need to do is pay attention to everybody. We don't know everybody's full story.
We're talking about suicide survivors, attempters, and the creative arts in healing. We're talking with Jonathan Singer and Terry Erbacher. Will be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
As a nurse with a bachelor's degree, you are essential to leading improvements in healthcare. A master's degree from the College of Nursing at Villanova is designed to advance your career as a nurse practitioner, nurse anesthetist, nurse educator, or administrator. The college, which also offers the DNP and PhD in nursing, understands your commitment to balancing career, family, and education. The College of Nursing at Villanova University supports WHYY. Villanova.edu/nursing.
In 14 years on Saturday Night Live, Daryl Hammond did many impressions, including Bill Clinton.
I rehearsed it with a southern accent, and then I put in this little crackle in my voice.
Few of the cast members knew Hammond struggled with drink, drugs, and self-cutting as a result of childhood abuse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Daryl Hammond. He has a new memoir.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about suicide, survivors, attempters. My guests are Terry Erbacher. She's a school psychologist for the Delaware County Intermediate Unit. Jonathan Singer is an assistant professor of social work at Temple, and he works with young people at risk for suicide. We had a caller earlier in the show. We didn't get to get her on, but she said she's a survivor and feels alone. She doesn't feel like there's a support group around. Is there one?
There is. In the Delaware Valley, we have what's called Survivors of Suicide, and they have support groups. We have at least one in every county, if not more. And you can look it up, just Google Survivors of Suicide. I don't remember the website offhand, or go to www.afsp.org. And this support groups are all led by other survivors. So it's not a psychologist or clinician running them. It's all led by survivors. And the idea there is it's other people who understand what survivors are going through to build that connection. They're wonderful. And again, there's at least one in every county. Most of them run about once a month.
We are learning more and more about the healing power of being with kindred spirits, people who just get it. You don't need a lot of words. They just get it. And that is so important and so healing, and that's what the mural's about. That's what the storytelling is about. What's the website again for the storytelling workshop?
Yeah, so it's storytellingmural.org. And when you go to that website, what you can do is you can share your story anonymously, or if you choose to add your name, you can do that. Or you can read stories. Now, this website is officially going live on the 13th of November. So if you show up to the website right now, I don't think there are any stories on there. But there will be, and this is a place that survivors and people who have helped folks through a suicidal crisis can find a virtual community by reading other stories and sharing.
I've got a question for the two of you that I really struggled with. It was awkward to write. I didn't want to write it, and I didn't want to say it. And, well, I'll just say it. Survivors. Families who survive struggle with guilt, with shame and isolation, and the struggle is unfathomable. And the guilt is, you know, about the woulda, coulda, shoulda phenomenon. On the other hand, you know, they say, is there something I could have or should have done differently? And as a human being, we say no. We say no. We can't add to the pain. On the other hand, and this is the awkward part, we tell families now for prevention what they can do, what they should do, what they must be alert to. That sounds like a contradiction. So that's the awkward question.
I think it is awkward, and I think that what you're speaking about is working with somebody who is in so much kind of self-flagellation that they don't need you to add to it, versus talking with somebody who might not be anxious enough about what's going on in their family to act. And so I think that both are legitimate approaches to working with families and loved ones. And I think that it's really important to talk about warning signs, risk factors, and saying these are what you should do if your kid or loved one is suicidal versus self-compassion. And you just had a show about that recently.
Yeah, so give people what they need for healing themselves or their loved ones. Terry?
I was just going to add to that. A lot of people suffer in silence. So we do want to educate on warning signs as best as we can. But there will be that percentage that suffer in silence, and they really hid their warning signs. And so maybe there was nothing in that case a family could do. You know, one of the analogies I'll give to families a lot, too, when they say to me, I didn't understand what they were going through to be so suicidal, that to me is a good thing. That means you are not in the depths of despair, that you understood what your loved one was going through. Sometimes that helps them, you know, too.
Could you mention a few of the warning signs, please, Terry?
Sure. Well, I go back to Debbie, actually. One of the things that struck me with what she had just said was feeling a burden. I felt like a burden, you know, my kids would be better without me. Feeling like a burden is a big one. You've talked a lot about isolation. That's huge. Depression in and of itself. Suffering any recent trauma would be one. So if they lost a loved one in their own lives, especially if it was through traumatic means.
Or being in an abusive relationship.
Or being in an abusive relationship, any kind of trauma.
There's also something we heard earlier on the, I think, Clara Williams essay. Was about she got frightened when she thought she was going to hurt her husband, so that irritability, anger, aggression doesn't look like depression. But that isn't. It's a risk factor.
It absolutely is. Irritability is huge. Sometimes, you know, after a recent incarceration or mental health treatment facility, coming back into the mainstream population is a risk factor. Mm-hmm. Certainly economic struggles, and we are seeing some of that now with the way our economy is. That's a risk factor. Mm-hmm. I always end with any changes in behavior. You know, I deal a lot with students, so change in grades, but for adults too, change in eating habits, sleeping habits, someone who used to be active and suddenly is withdrawing. Any of those changes are things we'd want to keep an eye on.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Barbara on the line. Barbara?
Oh.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, my son Daniel killed himself with a gun 26 years ago. He was 20 years old. And still today, if I try to support people who have lost a child, and they say to me, how did Daniel die? I still can't say it. I say, oh, he died in Boston. I just can't bring myself to say that he killed himself.
What happens to you when they ask that question?
I just feel overwhelming shame and loss, and it's 26 years. You know, I've managed to build a life. I've had an active, productive life, but inside, nothing has changed.
Do you think it will? Would you like it to change?
Oh, of course. Of course. But there's such a stigma, as you mentioned. There is such a stigma of suicide, you know?
I'd like to hear, hang on for a minute, I'd like to hear from my guests about this issue of shame and stigma.
So I think that there's shame and stigma on the inside, the shame and stigma that you're feeling, and obviously the loss of your son, an awful tragedy, and one clearly that you are still feeling to this day, probably suggestive of what a loving mother you are. Then there's the external stigma, the public stigma, the stigma that other people have about what happened. And I guess my question for you would be, what would be the worst thing that could happen if you were able to tell your those folks that your son died by shooting himself?
Barbara, do we still have you? Barbara? No, I guess we don't have her.
it'll be a hypothetical question.
Yeah.
But I think that that's part of that. It sounds like she herself is at peace in many ways with what happened. She was able to tell us, strangers, over the radio. I don't know how many people are listening, but she said it. And then she said, and I can't tell it to somebody else who has gone through what I went through, which suggests to me that there's a sense of what are they going to think about me, about my kid. And I think about that in terms of the public stigma. So my question for her would be, what would be the worst thing that would happen if she actually said it?
Yeah. Go on, Tara.
I was just going to add to that, and I do commend you, Barbara, for saying that on radio. I know that was really hard for you. And that's why the survivors groups are so good, to be with other people. So, Barbara, you realize you're not alone, you know, or whoever else is out there realizes they're not alone, that other people who've lost children feel many of these same things. And just going back to the website Jonathan was talking about, that's why we want to do it virtually. You know, I wonder if it was easier for Barbara to do this on radio, where we know nothing but her first name, and she's not sitting here looking at us, you know, so there's no judgment. Whereas, you know, online, it's also anonymous, you know, so people can tell their stories, get that catharsis like we were talking about with Clara, but they don't have to have their names associated with it.
I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you for
joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Dan, for having us.
I've been talking about suicide, the hurt, the healing, with social worker and educator Jonathan Singer and psychologist Terry Erbecker. Along with Mike and Scott, I'm going to be on a panel this Sunday, November 13th, here at WHYY. It's part of Fox Chase's 20th anniversary of their risk assessment program. It's free, and for more information, go to the Fox Chase website. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about gambling addiction in light of greater accessibility of casinos here in Philadelphia. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas helped with the phones today, and she is our volunteer. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.
Tell me more.